Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, we tell you how one talented dancer performing in a famous New York theater is sharing his abilities with children in Africa. But first, American colleges and universities have a new program to give foreign engineering students a chance to study and work in the United States. VOA reporter Karen Leggett has more.
American colleges and universities have a new program to give foreign engineering students a chance to study and work in the United States. It is called the Charles M. Vest Grand Challenges for Engineering International Scholarship Program. The Grand Challenges are 14 big problems that could be solved by engineers in the 21st century. They include making energy from the sun more economical, providing more clean water, preventing nuclear terror, and making better medicines. 8 American universities each offered one VEST scholarship in 2014. Rich Miller is the president of Franklin W. Olin College of Engineering in Massachusetts. He talks about the type of VEST scholars Olin College is seeking.
The concept is to try to find very highly gifted individuals who are likely to make a difference in their generation. They're up-and-comers, people who are in graduate school now, who have ambitions to make a difference on a large scale. We believe that the next generation, in order to achieve that vision, are going to have to work across the globe.
The first class of VEST scholars has already been selected. Applicants must propose a one-year research and study plan connected to one of the grand challenges. Applications for the next class are being accepted now at www.vestscholars.org. Another program for young foreign engineers is Frontiers of Engineering, organized by the National Academy of Engineering. Young engineers from 30 to 45 years old come together to listen to presentations about the newest developments in all types of engineering. Two engineers who study earthquakes in the United States and India met at a Frontiers of Engineering meeting in the United States in 2012. Nicholas Luco, with the United States Geological Survey, talked about designing nuclear power plants that can withstand earthquakes.
Make sure that you design for some ground motion that has a small chance of happening. We want to be pretty conservative. But this newer method goes beyond that and says we want to really be able to quantify what is the chance of damage to the power plant, what level of ground shaking should we designed for.
C.S. Manohar is an engineer from Bangalore, India, who listened to Mr. Luco and invited him to come to India. Both of these engineers want stronger building rules to deal with the risk of earthquakes in all buildings, not just nuclear power plants. These engineers are now looking for money to pay for further cooperation. But already, Mr. Manohar says,
actually, it has not translated into any specific action, but even the mere awareness is also very important.
Building awareness and connections is what the Frontiers of Engineering program is all about. The Frontiers of Engineering meetings are planned for and by younger engineers. There is a meeting in India in May, one in Japan in June, and one in California in September. I'm Karen Leggett.
And I'm Jonathan Evans. You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. Many dancers and actors dream of performing on Broadway in New York City. One American dancer is living his dream. But he also shares his talents by teaching students in Rwanda. Bob Doty has more.
American Lamar Baylor spends most of his time in New York City. He works as a performer in the Broadway musical The Lion King. But since 2011, he has also spent weeks in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda. There, he teaches dance to boys who live on the street. His teaching is part of an effort by the Rebecca Davis Dance Company. The project helps young people learn more about dance and learn how to behave in a classroom environment. Lamar Baylor describes his students as genocide survivors. They have lost all of their families. Some have been in jail. Others have sold their bodies for sex.
They have been through things that no one should ever have to go through.
He says dance classes provide the children with structured learning and self-expression that they have never had before. Rebecca Davis is the founder and director of the dance company. She says she got the idea for the project after she visited Rwanda in 2008. She remembers meeting a large number of street children who were dancing, and she thought that dance could be used to get them off the street and into a safer place. Rebecca Davis believes that learning to dance is a step toward education.
When you start to play music in Rwanda, these kids come out of nowhere and they enter the center. And it's because of dance that they have a way of exchanging their physicality, their survival skills that they learn on the street, and their strength into something that's actually artistic and aesthetic.
She says children can take classes in information and technology after they have learned to attend classes and follow directions. Boys who have done best in the classes win scholarships and are sent to the Sunrise Boarding School. About 30 boys have won this kind of financial aid. She says all the students are male because few girls in Rwanda live freely on the street. The Rwanda program is the largest one set up by the Rebecca Davis Dance Company. But Ms. Davis has also set up dance programs in Bosnia-Herzegovina and Guinea. About 2,000 children in the three countries have taken part in the project since it was launched in 2010. As for Lamar Baylor, he knows from his own experience how dance can lead to a better life. He is from Camden, New Jersey. Camden has sometimes been called America's poorest and most dangerous city. Mr. Baylor says that growing up in Camden, it took a long time for him to find out what he wanted to do. He now thinks dancing saved his life. I'm Bob Doty.
And that's our program for today. Be sure to join again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
Now, the VOA Special English Program, Words and Their Stories. Some expressions describe people who are important, or who at least think they are. One such expression is bigwig. In the 17th century, important men in Europe began to wear false hair called wigs. As years passed, wigs began to get bigger. The size of a man's wig depended on how important he was. The more important he was, or thought he was, the bigger the wig he wore. Some wigs were so large They covered a man's shoulders or back. Today, the expression bigwig is used to make fun of a person who feels important. People never tell someone he is a bigwig. They only use the expression behind his back. Big wheel is another way to describe an important person. A big wheel may be the head of a company, a political leader, a famous movie star. They are big wheels because they are powerful. What they do affects many people. Big wheels give the orders, other people carry them out. As in many machines, a big wheel makes the little wheels turn. Big wheel began a popular expression after World War II. It probably comes from an expression used for many years by people who fix parts of cars and trucks. They said a person rolled a big wheel if he was important and had influence. The top of something is the highest part. So it is not surprising that top is part of another expression that describes an important person. The expression is top banana. A top banana is the leading person in a comedy show. The funniest comedian is called the top banana. The next is second banana, and so on. Why a banana? A comedy act in earlier days often included a part where one of the comedians would hit the others over the head with a soft object. The object was shaped like the yellow fruit, the banana. Top banana still is used mainly in show business. Yet the expression can also be used to describe the top person in any area. A kingpin is another word for an important person. The expression comes from the game of bowling. The kingpin is the number one pin. If hit correctly with the bowling ball, the kingpin will make all the other nine pins fall. And that is the object of the game. So the most important person in a project or business is the kingpin. If the kingpin is removed, the business or project is likely to fail. Kingpin is often used to describe an important criminal or the leader of a criminal gang. A newspaper may report, for example, that police have arrested the suspected kingpin of a car-stealing operation. This VOA Special English Program, Words and Their Stories, was written by Marilyn Cristiano. I'm Warren Shear.
I'm Doug Johnson.
And this is Shirley Griffith with the special English program, People in America. Today, we complete our report about the life and work of 19th century American poet Walt Whitman.
Last week, we told about how Walt Whitman published his book of poems, Leaves of Grass, in 1855. He was 36 years old. Leaves of Grass was written in a new poetic language as natural as breath. Whitman had created a new kind of poetry, the first true American poetry.
I believe a leaf of grass is no less than the journey work of the stars, and the pismire is equally perfect, and a grain of sand, and the egg of the wren, and the cow crunching with depressed head surpasses any statue.
Whitman's poetry praises and celebrates the natural world of plants, animals, humans, rocks, stars, and oceans. The long poem, Song of Myself, is his most famous. It begins,
I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me as good belongs to you. The atmosphere is not a perfume, it is odorless. It is for my mouth forever. I am in love with it. I will go to the bank by the wood and become undisguised and naked. I am mad for it to be in contact with me. The smoke of my own breath, my respiration and inspiration, the beating of my heart, the passing of blood and air through my lungs.
Some years ago, critic Malcolm Cowley wrote about how Walt Whitman became a poet. It was a mystery, he said. It happened almost overnight. Cowley said he believes Whitman's need to write poetry developed as he came to recognize his sexual nature. Whitman was homosexual. He loved men. As a poet of praise, he wanted to praise his own true nature, but he also wanted to remain partly hidden and protected. So his language sometimes is direct, and sometimes is not.
I believe in you, my soul, and the other I am must not abase itself to you, and you must not be abased to the other. I mind how once we lay such a transparent summer morning, how you settled your head athwart my hips and gently turned over upon me, and parted the shirt from my bosom bone, and plunged your tongue to my bare-stripped heart.
To some British readers, Whitman's poetry sounded like the true voice of Americans. It was free and powerful. It was common and sweet as the open air. British writer Robert Louis Stevenson wrote that Leaves of Grass turned the world upside down for him. Yet most readers in Britain and the United States rejected Whitman. Many were shocked by the poetry's new form and open sexuality. Many booksellers refused to sell Leaves of Grass. Most leading critics dismissed it. Whitman's brother even criticized the poetry. Walt, he said,
hasn't the world made it plain that it would rather not have your book? Why then don't you call the game off?
America's Civil War began in 1861. The southern states had broken away to protect their rights against the central government. They especially wanted to protect their legal right to own black slaves. The northern states fought the South to save the Union and free the slaves. Walt Whitman had worked for many years for newspapers and groups that wanted the black man to be free. He believed that all people are equal in their humanity. So he supported the Northern cause. But at 41 years of age, he was too old to fight. His younger brother George, however, joined immediately.
In the second year of the war, a big battle was fought near Fredericksburg, Virginia. George Whitman was an officer in the Union forces at Fredericksburg. Walt and his mother worried that George might have been wounded in the battle. So Walt went to look for George among the wounded. He looked for his brother at hospitals in Washington, the nation's capital. He did not find his brother there, so he traveled to Fredericksburg. His brother had been wounded, but not seriously. George asked Walt to stay at the camp for a few days. Walt stayed more than a week, helping care for the wounded. He even helped bury some of the dead.
Walt found satisfaction in what he was doing. He decided to spend time in Washington helping where he could. There were few nurses or visitors there, and there were hundreds of injured and dying soldiers at Army hospitals. Walt Whitman was a tall, strong man. He was calm and kind. He sat beside the sick and dying men for hours. He wrote letters for them. He gave them water to drink. He brought them gifts of food and money. He hoped that his support and care would help some men to survive.
Whitman received no pay for his work among the wounded. He needed money to live in Washington. A friend found him a part-time job in the Army Pay Office, copying papers for a few hours a day. The pay was low, but Whitman did not need much money. For 3 hours each morning, he worked at the pay office. Then he went to one of the many hospitals in the city to visit the wounded. Around 4 p.m, he usually left to eat his dinner. Then he would return to the hospital, staying until 9 or 10 at night.
Whitman often saw President Abraham Lincoln riding his horse between the White House and a home for soldiers just outside Washington. Whitman wrote, "Mr. Lincoln wears a black stiff hat and looks as ordinary in dress as the commonest man. I see very clearly Lincoln's dark brown face with the deep-cut lines, the eyes, always to me, with a deep, hidden sadness. We have got so that we exchange bows, very friendly ones." In March 1864, Lincoln was sworn in as president for the second time. Whitman was in the crowd of thousands who watched the ceremony.
The days following the inauguration were beautiful spring days. The terrible Civil War was ending. Whitman wrote about the beautiful spring weather that made lilacs and other spring flowers bloom early. The nights were especially nice, he said. And a star in the western sky seemed to glow especially bright, as if it had something to tell the world. On the Friday before Easter, Whitman and the nation learned that Lincoln had been shot and killed. Whitman felt a deep personal loss. Slowly, he built the poem he called When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed. This is how it begins.
When lilacs last in the dooryard bloomed, and the great star early drooped in the western sky in the night, I mourned, and yet shall mourn with ever-returning spring. O powerful western fallen star, here, coffin that slowly passes, I give you my sprig of lilac.
Critic Malcolm Cowley wrote that Whitman's best poems seem to have been made just this morning. They seem freshly painted, and they make us see the world in a new way.
Whitman's last years were troubled by poverty and increasing sickness. He continued to write poetry. Every few years, he published a new edition of Leaves of Grass, putting in new poems. Sales of the book increased a little, but few Americans recognized Whitman's greatness. In Britain, however, he was seen as the outstanding voice of the New World. Whitman's health began to fail when he was in his early 50s. He went to Camden, New Jersey, to live with his brother George. It was a lonely life in a strange town. To keep himself busy, Whitman wrote for New York newspapers and magazines, and he added more lines to Leaves of Grass. Walt Whitman did not fear death, which came in 1892. He was 73. Many years earlier, he had written,
"And as to you, death, and you, bitter hug of mortality, it is idle to try to alarm me. I depart as air. I shake my white locks at the runaway sun. I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look for me under your boot soles. You will hardly know who I am or what I mean, but I shall be good health to you nevertheless."
This special English program was written by Richard Thorman and Carolyn Weaver. It was produced by Paul Thompson. Rich Kleinfeld read the poetry. I'm Doug Johnson.
And I'm Shirley Griffith. Listen again next week for another People in America program on VOA.